Welcome, everybody. This is Diana Oblinger with EDUCAUSE, and you're participating in the EDUCAUSE Analytics Sprint. The sprint is made possible by a couple of organizations we want to take a moment to thank. First of all, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and also IBM, one of the EDUCAUSE Silver Partners. And without their help, we wouldn't be able to be here today. Now, today is the final day of a three-day sprint, and a sprint is an intense three-day set of online activities. And this year, we're focused on analytics. You're here as a part of the webinar, but you know that we've got lots more to offer as part of the sprint. We've got guest bloggers, Twitter, IdeaScale, and community polls. And I hope you will be sure to take advantage of all that the event has to offer. Just go visit the sprint website, and you'll be able to find your way to lots of different resources. Now, just a word about the webinar, because it is designed to be interactive, and there are two different spaces I want to specifically point out to you. One is on the left-hand side of your screen, and it's a chat pod, and that's where we'd like to invite you to share comments that you've got, insights, URLs. If you want to chat together, please use that left-hand side of the screen. In the middle, underneath the slides, there is another chat space that says, submit a question for the speaker. We'd like to reserve that for your questions. So if you've got a question you'd like us to tee up for the speaker, if you would type it in there, we will be keeping track of those. Now, we may get more questions than we have time for answers, but if you've got a question, please post it there. And we'll be watching that throughout the program today. Now, in between those two pods is another space that says roster, and that's a roster of the attendees. And if you want to send a private message to someone in that list, if you just hover your cursor over their name, you'll be able to then select Start Private Chat. And near the top of that roster is a name that I want you to take note of if you have any problems, and that's Technical Help. If you've got any technical questions or you need assistance, just send a private message to Technical Help and we will get right to you. And for those of you who would like to join the back channel, you can tweet using the hashtag EDUSPRINT, EDUSPRINT. And as many of you probably know, we will archive today's session, the slides, as well as the full program on the Sprint website later on today. Now, if you haven't been with us for all 3 days, let me give you a quick recap. We began with President Freeman Hrabowski from University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a couple of his colleagues, Jack Seuss and Michael Dillon. And we heard a lot from them, things like analytics requires a culture of inquiry, and inquiry creates an analytics culture, that leaders have to ask good questions, that analytics is about working across boundaries, and analytics is a significant institutional investment. On day two, we explored how analytics can inform learning. And we heard from Marsha Lovett from Carnegie Mellon University and her work with learner dashboards and faculty, and from Ellen Wagner from WCET talking about the PAR project where they've aggregated literally hundreds of thousands of student records. And those sessions are on the Analytics Sprint website if you would like to replay them at your convenience. And today, to conclude the sprint, we're focused on putting data into the hands of stakeholders in usable and understandable formats. So today's webinar is on analytics for enterprise efficiency and effectiveness. And of course, analytics is a problem-solving process where we can ask important questions, identify relevant data, conduct analyses, explore options, communicate, and hopefully take action on what we've learned. But analytics requires teamwork and a lot of collaboration across divisions. We've heard about analytics initiatives from the academic side, but they also involve the entire university community and involve areas like student affairs, institutional research, finance, facilities, and even more. And today, what we want to do is stay focused on the enterprise level. And we've got two experienced institutions joining us today, the University of Washington and Arizona State University. And our first speakers are from the University of Washington. And UW, as you may know, has developed a very successful model for managing enterprise data and building data quality in a highly distributed environment. And that may be the kind of environment many of you are in. Sarah Gomez is joining us. She is the Associate Vice President for Information Management. And she manages a university-wide leadership program in developing and managing UW's information management initiatives, as well as its administrative systems and applications. Bill Yock is the Director of Enterprise Information Systems and is currently in charge of the Enterprise Data Warehouse and the service-oriented architecture development. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Sarah and Bill to tell us more about their success in addressing the challenges of data management. Sarah?
Thank you, Diane. We'd like to first start by thanking EDUCAUSE for inviting Bill and I to present UW's data governance journey. And just like any journey, you know, one of the questions that is always asked is, are we there yet? And, you know, while we are finding that we are well into our journey and we're making tremendous progress delivering real business value to our community, we still have a great deal of work to do. Today, one of my goals is that one of the key takeaways of this presentation is the imperative for building a solid foundation and framework for any successful data governance program. These will be critical to gain adoption, acceptance, and most importantly, accountability across your institutions. This next slide just shows, again, the breadth and the scope of the University of Washington. We are celebrating our 150th year, and if you can imagine the rich culture that we have built over those years. We are multi-campus, 17 schools and colleges, 12,000 degrees annually, again, close to 50,000 students, 50 centers. We're one of the largest research institutions in the country, if not the world. Our annual operating budget, close to over $5.5 billion. That does include our medical enterprise. And I think, like most state institutions, a pretty staggering figure in terms of the cut in our state funding since 2009 and how important student tuition is in driving our budgets. The next line, really, we took a more of an informal inventory of our applications. Without even really trying hard, we came up with over 700 applications in our portfolio, primarily central, some decentralized, but we're well into the thousands of applications across our very decentralized campus. You know, in telling our story today, we're going to be using an analogy to our U.S. Constitution and our democratic conventions. And though for our international guests, we also hope that you find these truths and principles to really be universal. When we started the governance program, we didn't necessarily have this in mind. So it really has been reflecting back after several years that we found this analogy to be very similar, and many features of this framework hold the same value for us. This outline will also serve as the agenda for our presentation. So starting with what sounds simple in terms of free the data, and again, UW is a very central, decentralized environment with many, many years, 150 years of rich history and culture built up around that data. Our continued data battle, you know, really has the traditional assaults on all of these fronts, data access, data quality, data understanding, and big challenge in integrating data from many of our shadow systems and stovepipes. And again, this had been a root issue and a rallying cry for many, many years on how to resolve these issues. We use this analogy again that we felt like the data landscape was close to anarchy. We are one of the, again, largest institutions that still are running very old legacy systems. And while we have a roadmap to replace those systems, which I can probably see will be a whole other presentation in itself of how we maintain the currency of our data while we're changing out those transaction systems. Very, very hard to get data out of. You can imagine that early attempts to free the data were actually counterproductive in that it resulted in everyone getting their own copies of the data into their own shadow systems and trying to make sense of it. And literally hundreds of point-to-point interfaces have been built up. Compounding the issues, not having clear understanding of complex business rules of the system, and really which led people to create what seemed like similar reports, but yet had different results and different numbers. And from here, you can imagine the lack of trust and the many versions of the truth that had sprung up over the years. Another critical success factor for launching our data governance program was having a credible, respected member of our faculty to really help champion the cause and to help influence our provost to take action. In our case, this particular person was Mike Eisenberg, who was Dean Emeritus and Professor of our Information School, and we actually referred to him as our first data czar. Mike led a task force for the provost that resulted in a report that highlighted several of the challenges that we faced. Though one of the many outcomes that flowed from this, we referred to as our Declaration of Independence, and it really was a charter from our provost at the time, Phyllis Wise, who is now chancellor at the University of Illinois at the Champaign-Urbana campus for some of our Illinois friends, to form the Data Management Committee. The provost charge letter invited approximately 20 university employees to serve. As you can see here, there are three primary purposes that have been outlined: to establish consistent approaches, to provide clear structures and models, and also definitions and guidance and recommendations going forward. And again, the definitions have just been a key part of this. Charge letter led to the official creation of the Data Management Committee, which really was one of the key foundational points of our governance program. Mike chaired the DMC initially along with Bill Yock. Again, I think this demonstrates one of the points that Diana made earlier about the collaboration that must occur across the enterprise and how analytics crosses many boundaries. So here we just wanted to pause and take one of our first polls and just get a sense from the community of how did your data governance program begin? In looking at the choices, again, in our case, it was really official decree. We had a top-down directive by the provost. Again, these are several factors that I think based on your institution, based on your culture, based on your organization, there'd be many factors that influence that. So in looking at the data coming in here, what are we seeing? Looks like we still have a lot of you that are looking to begin a data governance program, and again, hopefully you'll get some good information on that. And again, in the case of the University of Washington, we really felt to solve the root core issues across our very decentralized institution, this needed to come from the top level of the institution. So that looks great. Okay, moving on. This next quote, I think, really exemplifies what I would say is the sheer will, you know, perseverance and determination it will take to not only launch a data governance program, but also the challenges in sustaining momentum and making real progress, like I said, on those core root issues. One of the first tasks that the DMC undertook was the development of what we would call the Constitution, or otherwise known as UW's Institutional Data Management Standards. And of course, and like in any large enterprise, this did not happen overnight. And I know this might sound a little staggering, but in fact, we iterated through 23 different versions of a course of 3 years. And Bill is over here chuckling because he lived through all of those versions. But with that, what we were really gaining was considerable outreach, considerable vetting, and again, ownership and adoption. It was just officially signed into law last December by our Vice Provost of Planning and Budgeting, as well as the current chairs of our DMC, which is our Dean of Libraries, and also our AVP of Information and Data Management. So again, very widespread input. One of the main sections of this document we would refer to as our Bill of Rights, or the 10 fundamental principles. We patterned many of these after our peers with similar charters. So again, thanks to you out in the community that we were able to solicit information from. They really have provided us a framework for articulating foundational practices around value, quality, access, use, and administration. And, you know, like any type of guiding principles, to me, these really stick. They have proven to provide real governance for us. One of these in particular, on the unnecessary duplication of data, actually has follow-on documents that we would call similar to amendments. And this one in particular is key because it ties back to one of those challenges that we have in being able to have accountability to govern directly over the proliferation of shadow systems. Because again, really trying to get our handle around these many sources of truth. In continuing our analogy here, in any democracy, it's very good to have checks and balances. And we always know, we've always loved this term, there'll be the data hawks and there's going to be the data doves. And so we need to make sure that there are fair and consistent practices in how we are protecting the right to free the data. So in our analogy to the branches of government, and again, this will show how enterprise and how widespread the reach is here at UW, we have approximately 25 data trustees and 55 data custodians. The data management committee is made up of 25 of these members, some of them being custodians themselves. And again, this structure continues to reinforce the collaboration and shared responsibility that must occur across the enterprise to effectively implement a data governance program. So data trustees are at the highest level of the institution. They are vice presidents and vice provosts who have delegated authority over the business domains, and they designate the custodians. Custodians, in turn, are AVPs, associate, assistant, vice presidents, and vice provosts. They're directors and managers that have several duties that Bill will talk to further. The Data Management Committee functions as a legislative branch to help coordinate and define policies, standards, and guidelines. And in addition to the three main branches of government, we also have what we would call a couple of administrative cabinet posts that help to assist the governance. Again, my role as Associate Vice President of Information Management is a strategic data trustee that I have responsibilities in coordinating overall systems and data management technologies. I help to ensure that the appropriate infrastructures and technical standards are in place. And an example of the Standards Implementation Committee is a subset of the DMC. And again, where we have subset committees that help to operate, they triage issue, they plan agendas, and they generally coordinate the communications. At this point, I'd like to hand it over to Bill Yoff, who again is our Director of Enterprise Information Services. And Bill has really been just what I'd say, again, instrumental in founding and leading our data governance program here at the UW. So with that, we'll hand it over to Bill.
Thanks, Sarah. So Sarah's talking about our data governance journey, and it's really a journey to meet the charge of information for decision making across the university. And she's so far talked about the revolution in our Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the branches of government. I'm now going to talk a little bit more about some of the ways that we actually execute on these programs, projects, and initiatives. But just to finish up on the branches of government, Sarah just mentioned that we have, in essence, three branches with trustees, custodians, and the Data Management Committee. And really, we needed a method to assign accountability for the what we're calling our legislative districts across the university. And so we came up with this concept of a data map. And you see a representation of it here. It's the three areas across the top are sort of the mission-oriented areas of our university where there's academics, research, and university advancement. The bottom domains representing human resources, financial resources, services. Those are the services and support areas that we're working on. And then we also have this sweet spot in the middle that we call master data domain, and those are the data points that really cross over all the other domains, and we need special management of those data points. But we really needed a way to divide the landscape up and assign accountabilities, and this is the way that we did it. So within each of those areas, you'll see, in essence, data domains or business process domains, in essence. And we assign the various custodians and trustees to those areas. And those assignments really changed the conversation from a conversation of ownership to more of a conversation of stewardship. And that was one of the key areas that we focused on here. It was really to find the people that really understood the business processes of the university that provided good stewardship over the data of the university, and not so much who generated or where the data originated from, you know, which systems and so forth. And as Sarah mentioned, we came up today, according to this map, we have about 50-plus custodians assigned and 20-plus trustees assigned to these different jurisdictions. So a part of the Data Management Committee's responsibility is to help to write rules, guidance, standards, and policy documents. It's often quite difficult to find the right words if anybody's ever had the privilege of trying to write these types of documents. But it is a very necessary thing to do to provide guidance and direction for the university and data management practices. And so the amendments are what we refer to as guideline documents. And this is a sample of some of the various guideline documents that have come about over the years. I'll just mention one here in particular. The cross-unit access to financial data was really all about transparency of financial data across units. It was one dean allowing another dean to see that other dean's budget. And, you know, come up with a policy around that transparency, it required a broad conversation across the university. So we had committees working to receive advisory opinions to help us to define that guideline. But we defined that guideline, and it was signed by the trustees, and it was scanned and published onto the Data Management Committee website, and it's become sort of an official policy, so to speak, for the university. And then as, you know, future data governance challenges have come about, we've been able to go back to those guideline documents and use them to help us to make decisions. So we sort of call this our case law library, where we're building up a library of cases for precedents. Some of these are referring to the Enterprise Data Warehouse, which I'm responsible for here. And so I like to refer to a lot of these as getting Bill out of the middle of some difficult conversations. And so these have been very good for me to help decide and define things like who can have access to the data in the data warehouse, because some of that data is pretty sensitive. Before I move on into the legislative committees, I apologize, I got the order of these slides a bit mixed up. I'd rather actually go to this next poll before we go on to the legislative committee. So let me stop here and ask all of you, how do you do data stewardship at your institution? Is it similar to what we've just described to you here? Do you have representation based on many functional areas or business processes like our data map? Do you have stewards assigned more on line of business systems areas like finance, HR, or whatnot? Is it really sort of by a committee or appointed or elected of a certain officials that maybe are made up of subject matter experts? Is it, you know, more grassroots, small group, individual types of responsibilities, or in a lot of cases, institutional research departments have this primary responsibility? And in a lot of cases, technical systems managers, IT managers, data warehouse managers are asked to do it by default. And in some cases, it could be all of the above. Interesting poll statistics. A lot of it seems to be lining up more towards the line of business and accountability that way. And I do see that the institutional research or smaller group also seems to be quite prevalent too. So very interesting. So thanks, everybody. So, yes, let me back up just 1 second, and then we'll move forward on. So the Data Management Committee meets every couple of weeks, and we've been doing that for many, many years now. And one of the things that we do is we charter special legislative subcommittees, task forces, to work on difficult challenges. So let me move on here to some examples of legislative committees. I'm going to talk about four of them. There's been many of them over the years, but I'm going to focus on some that are directly related to some of the challenges of data quality and also analytics in producing the analytics for the university. So university or higher ed environments are probably one of the most complex organizational structures on the face of the planet. with all the different types of employment structures and faculty structures, academic program structures, and whatnot. So I'm going to talk more about that in just a second and some of the challenges that we've found around our organization and the coding of our organizational structures. I'll talk also briefly about giving access to data and how we are accomplishing that in the data warehouse. But then the last two here, the top five questions and the Dean's Advisory Group and Enterprise Reporting Services, these are very specific analytical types of projects that were created to tackle some of our tough data definitional challenges in defining and understanding institutional metrics and reports. So first up, let me mention here organizational codes and organizational structures. So this diagram here represents our org structure, our org chart. The blue boxes represent the traditional type of hierarchy that you probably have in your institutions as well. At the top level is sort of the president or university level. There is the campus level, college level, sub-college department, and so forth. What we found, though, is that what makes this difficult is that there, for the different data domains throughout this, the data is associated at different levels, we find. So academic types of things that we're producing, like degrees or majors, or even admissions, hang at different levels of the org structure. HR associations, administrative homes, the academic appointments and whatnot are at different levels of the structure. Budgets and finance and accounts are at, could go all the way down to the sub-department level, where in some cases we allow our organizational units to actually define their own sub-department structures. All of this makes organizational coding structure extremely complex. We had a special committee report that's out on our Data Management Committee website highlighting the challenges of this master data management challenge for the university. But rationalizing this structure, understanding it, has been key for us to produce and reports. Also key to getting the data out and freeing it up has been, ironically, creating finer grain controls to it. And around our data warehouse, we created a system refer to as DAC, Data Access Control. And basically, the interesting thing about this technology is that it puts into the hands of our data custodians, our stewards, the ability to assign the roles and define the classification of the data and the sensitivity of that data by roles. And then as people get added into the roles, we have confidence that they're accessing the correct data that they need for their jobs. Before we had this system in place, our custodians were relying on IT to try to create very complex security and access controls, and they didn't have the visibility into that. But now that the control is in the hands of our data custodians, we've been able to go from like 200 users to 5,000 users with access to the data warehouse. And I think that's one of the key reasons we were recognized just recently with a Technology Innovation Award from Campus Technology. I mentioned the top five questions project. I know that you can't read this chart, but I can just tell you that this was an interesting project in which our current provost at the time was executive vice provost. She was leading up a dean's advisory group where deans were actually asked, what are the top five questions you want to have answered? That's sort of represented in this left-hand column. Well, of course, those questions are not easy to answer. You know, just the question of what is my student headcount by major, gets complicated in are we counting non-matriculated, what about the on-leave students, and so forth. So that led to a whole bunch of issues, definitional issues, that we had to come up with or arrive at common definitions to be able to answer those types of questions. And you can see this one project, those five questions, led to 20 or 30 some different high-level institutional metric definitions that were defined. That top five project led into a broader program, enterprise reporting services type of program, in which it's interesting, administrative units, academic units across campus are coming together and working to build analytics and reports for the enterprise. You can see the purple boxes here are governance trustees, custodians, committee members. The blue boxes are those stakeholders and the units out there. The orange boxes represents our sponsors and stakeholders. And you can see it's a very broad conversation across the university, which is really necessary to answer those analytic challenges. And the dean's advisory group has morphed into an academic administrator advisors around the enterprise analytics. And here's a screenshot of one of the analytics that came out of the enterprise reporting services. We call it the performance evaluation metrics report, or also affectionately known as the provost evaluation metrics. And this is an actual report that the provost will use when they, at budget time, they'll sit down with the deans and they'll see, you know, for the first time, you know, sort of benchmarks, statistics on the general performance of the units and departments. Now, it's interesting as we came up with these definitions and terminology that, again, it was a conversation, a broad conversation through subcommittees working very closely together with the deans to produce those analytics and publish those. So I'd like to stop and introduce another poll regarding the how your institutions collaborate on producing analytics. Do you have academic and administrative departments both producing reports and then publishing them centrally? Or is it primarily a central IT and institutional research unit working with subject matter experts to do the publication? Have you ever involved your deans or the deans, college administrators, and analysts in defining those results? And do you have any kind of shared support between IT and the business units and academic units in helping to answer questions that might come up as a part of that? So interestingly, it looks like the majority of collaboration here is central IT working with institutional research unit to produce the majority of institutional analytics. So thanks everybody for voting on that. So the very last section here is regarding my department, what I refer to as the Department of State. I'd like to think of us as the ambassadors working on behalf of IT and working very closely with the business to deliver services to the university. We have an enterprise data warehouse team that's actively building out the data in the warehouse, and we've started to implement business intelligence services, metadata management services, and training and education services that I'll touch on real quickly here because I know we're running out of time. First of all, this is some sample of business intelligence types of reports that we use ourselves, our own team, to see how much query execution is going on across the university. You can see over the last few years, we have increased about 30,000 query executions a month, I believe. The primary amount of data in the data warehouse today is around finance and HR, some academics, and you can see we're just getting started on research data build out, and that research is starting to build up and be delivered to the campus as well. So just some samples of us using BI to, you know, monitor our own environment. This is a screenshot of a tool that we've created to help us with those definitional challenges, the metadata management. This allows the subject matter experts on my team to work with the data custodians across the campus to actually document the institutional metrics, and you can see this particular example of cumulative additional applied credits. That's a very interesting calculation that we've been working on. And lastly, it's been very important for us to put in place a training and communication program, not only around the use of the tools and the data around the BI tools, but also around the data in the data warehouse and the meaning and understanding of that. And we're actually targeting specific units on campus and then monitoring our success by seeing if the usage patterns go up across the units on the campus. So let me just finish with this last poll and ask all of you, do you have your own data warehouse program, or are you maybe just running the data warehouse that comes from an ERP vendor? Do you have a active BI intelligence services where you're producing analytics and dashboards and delivering that to campus? Do you have your own metadata management services and collaborations going on with your business stakeholders? And do you have any kind of formal BI training and communication services going on around your programs? So not a big surprise to me that most of you have some data warehouse that you've been working on building and that you're doing producing analytics and reports on top of that. We are ourselves just getting started on the metadata and the training and communication, so that's a relatively new one for us. And I'm glad to see that others are already doing that out there too. So that's it from here at the UW. We're certainly happy to answer a couple of quick questions if we have any time.
We have lots of questions, and maybe more than we'll be able to get to. But just to build on your last slide here, Bill, I assume that people can find the documents publicly, and you've given us websites. So I assume you're going to see lots of hits from people on the webcast for the documents you're willing to share. One of the questions, considering a lot of people do not have as sophisticated a system in place as you all do, is how long should people think that developing these data governance policies and data models should take them? A year, 2 years, 5 years? What do you think?
You know, I would just, this is Sarah, I would just start and say a lot of that I think is dependent on the size and scope of your institution. And here, because we were trying to, you know, deal with so many root issues, I mean, we're going on since about 2006. So while 6 years seems like a long time, again, getting that broad consensus and building that up, I would, again, Bill, you'd say two to three years would seem like an average expectation. And even kind of back to my opening comment about, you know, the journey and are we there yet and are we done yet, you know, it does seem like it's a continuing journey.
I would also want to echo what I mentioned earlier, that the case law library, as you set more precedents and you have sort of that library of things to go back and refer to, it gets easier. Things get done faster. So it seems a bit slow at first, but it's now starting to pick up, and we're starting to produce more and more all the time.
So another question from folks is, who's the custodian of the central master data?
Yeah, our Office of Planning and Budgeting, where our Institutional Studies and Research Department is located, is really positioned to be the master data management business owner and that sweet spot in the middle of the data map that we talked about. And so the organizational codes that we talked about earlier, they're taking an active role in helping to define it for consistency purposes. We're actively working on sponsor data right now, research sponsor data and sponsor data from gifts and donors and things like that. So it really takes sort of a central unit like that to coordinate at a very high level, a broad conversation to come to agreement on definitions of it.
You know, there were several questions that hovered around issues of governance and the amount of support that you've got. So would either Bill or Sarah, would you like to say any more about the data governance relationship between CIO, CTO, institutional research, who reports to who, so that folks get some additional ideas about how they might structure this at their institution?
I did see one of the questions that asked if UW has a CIO or CTO. And so just to start there, my position reports into our Vice President of IT and our CIO, Kelly Trosvik. But I think what is just clear, really key here, is that IT does not own this. or drive this, and I think that would be a challenge to have it driven from that perspective. We really are a key process partner, but it is to me that it's shared responsibility primarily with this Office of Planning and Budgeting and our institutional research partners, who are really our provost, you know, right-hand arm, and this, as Bill said, kind of the master data owners. But even with that partnership, then we get into all of the, again, the functional areas and the functional ownership over each of those domains. And, again, based on your size and breadth of your organization, it can become, you know, a complex governance structure, but, again, one that is just critical to solving, really getting to this, you know, the single source of truth and getting to the common definition level. So there's lots of, again, shared responsibility across both the academic and the administrative sides.
I'd also like just to add that for the Data Management Committee membership, we purposely designed it to have a co-chair type of relationship where it's shared between academic and administrative units. So we've been lucky to have deans co-chair alongside with folks like Todd Milden, our associate vice provost planning and budgeting department. And so it really helps to make sure that that conversation between administrative and academic happens.
And realizing that UW is a very large, complex institution, can you comment on how many FTE in IT support this environment and how many in institutional research? And we'll just remind people that early on Sarah described the size of the institution as almost 50,000 students in 17 different schools. So do you know about how many you've got in IT versus IR?
I'll mention that my team, the Decision Support Services team, which I talked about, is currently 17 members with a mix of business analysts, enterprise data warehouse, data loaders, enterprise data modelers, metadata management, and the training communication manager, and so forth. The planning and budgeting central unit is actually more of a virtual type of organization where it's not just planning and budgeting, but there are analysts and report developers that are in financial management and accounting area. There's HR information services area, the research information service. So it's actually a virtual matrix type of a team that where that enterprise reporting services bubble diagram that I showed earlier brings all of them together. I would say all together we have 20-some analyst-type folks that are actively building and producing or have the capability to produce and publish analytics through our central IT. And, again, it's a very collaborative effort.
So one of the questions that came in from Twitter earlier was, to see if you all have any advice you can offer on how small institutions can address the kind of complexity and the resource-intensive aspects of implementing a system like this. Any thoughts?
You know, Diana, I'm going to tie this actually back to a question which I think is a factor when someone said, how much did PeopleSoft influence your data map? And in our case, it was zero because we have actually legacy systems, you know, again, 30-year-old legacy systems that we do a lot of heavy lifting. So, again, that's a key factor. And my point there related to your question is that I think those that have more modern ERPs, those that have put in PeopleSoft Banner, Oracle, I think you're obviously have an advantage in that you're working with more modern data structures, and as you've gone through the implementations, you have a lot of this work kind of ahead of you. In our case, we had a ton of heavy lifting just to deal with the years of the legacy data. So on that side, I think that's a key factor. And again, just from our perspective here, and I would really emphasize, is the ownership and, again, the leadership from the top levels of the organization. I think we tried for many years to kind of do the grassroots bottom-up, and we were finding we weren't getting that enterprise approach. And so even for smaller institutions, to have the buy-in of your president, your provost, your key leaders who can help you with that authority and that accountability in governing over, you know, the data.
So one final question for you before we move over to hearing from our friends from Arizona State is, do you build information about these guidelines into employee training or employee handbooks?
We have just started implementing what we call data custodian forums. So twice a year we're actually having or bringing all the custodians together across the university and providing training, refresher courses, but also training courses on upcoming or current or emerging types of policies and guidelines. And we've also produced, if you go to our Data Management Committee website, there's online training that we've produced for the data custodians that provides some highlights as well. We anticipate doing more and more of that. We're getting started with a blog for the Data Management Committee as well that will be an avenue for communicating and educating folks as well. So it is a very important part of success for a governance program is to communicate it broadly.
Well, people are saying that it's absolutely an impressive effort. So thank you for sharing with us. We've certainly learned a lot. So thanks, Sarah and Bill. And our next presenters are from Arizona State University. And as you may know, ASU is known to be a leader in analytics. The president has been particularly behind it, and ASU is known for some of the dashboards that they've developed as well as visualizations. And I think I've learned personally a lot from them about how to put data into the hands of stakeholders in usable formats. We've got three folks from Arizona State with us today. Gordon Wishon, who is the Chief Information Officer. Before he joined ASU, he was at Notre Dame. Before that, Georgia Tech. Gordon also served 20 years in the Air Force and was the CIO at the Air Force Institute of Technology. John Rome is also with us. John is the Deputy CIO and Business Intelligence Strategist at ASU. John's been a pioneer of data warehousing and built ASU's first data warehouse around 1995. And Leah Lommel is the Assistant Vice President over Development in the University Technology Office. She's responsible for the Oracle PeopleSoft Systems support development, website development, degree audit reporting system, business intelligence, and general business analysis. So Gordon, John, and Leah, thank you for being with us. And Gordon, I think you're going to start.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you for the opportunity to give your listeners a glimpse into some of the things that are happening here at ASU with regard to analytics and leveraging data. We thought we would today give you some insight, first of all, into the institutional landscape and a bit of the imperative behind the drive to use data and leverage analytics at ASU. We'll talk a little bit about the products that we're using here at ASU and some of the applications that have been designed to support the academy, in particular the academy, but also other elements of the institution. We'll dwell just a little bit on best practices or lessons learned, and then talk about where we're heading next with the efforts here at ASU. So first, again, Diana, thank you for the introduction. I won't dwell on this other than to say that I have been here at ASU as the CIO for just 2 years. One of the things that I learned early on as a CIO was to hire people who are smarter than you are, and I've got two of the smartest people I know here with me today. So what is it that's driving this strong force, this strong focus on data and analytics at ASU? Well, like many of you, we are facing many of the same imperatives for change at our institution. Calls for budget cuts, calls for increased accountability to students and to those who are paying the bills. We're all being asked to respond with efficiency and effectiveness approaches aimed at cost savings opportunities, watching our spend on various products and services, consolidation of IT infrastructure and space, et cetera, et cetera. So we're also, of course, all in the public institutions across the country facing, nearly all, I should say, facing shrinking or flat budgets, and even the private institutions across the country certainly are not immune to these pressures. We're also all drowning in data, but historically we haven't done much with the data that we have or really leveraged it in a substantive way. And we're all dealing with data growth as one of the biggest IT challenges that we face today. And all of those CIOs, of course, would also like to see our multi-million-dollar investments in ERP systems to deliver more value. We've been investing now in ERP systems for more than 20 years, and it's only recently that we've begun to see the capability to leverage those investments. Finally, is the in the increased call for accountability, some institutions and university systems are beginning to move in the direction of performance-based management approaches. And as an example, the Arizona Board of Regents is calling for each of the public institutions in the state of Arizona to develop outcome-based measures of performance against which we as public institutions will be measured. We also continue to struggle to create insight from data. And historically, fundamentally, really, we've struggled to draw insight from all of this data that's been piling up in our ERP and the many ancillary systems that we've been investing in on campuses. And traditionally, of course, most IR shops and other reporting initiatives have been centered around compliance reporting. But all of the headlines today are pointing to business intelligence as a way to help address budget accountability and other IT issues that we're facing. We're seeing this every day, of course, in the headlines, and certainly entities like Gartner are pointing to business intelligence and leveraging analytics as among our top priorities. CIO Magazine has said similar things about big data. The hot IT skills in the future have to do with big data, MySQL, HBase, Cognos, Informatica. All of those are tools used to support analytics and leveraging the use of data. Well, let me digress for just a minute and say something about Arizona State, some of the outcomes that we've been able to achieve in the past few years. I'll pass by some of the marketing fluff fairly quickly, but just to say that that Arizona State is in the midst of a fundamental transformation. We're comprised of four physical campuses in the metropolitan Phoenix area with 72,000 students enrolled, FTE headcount, with another 6,000 enrolled in more than 20 graduate and undergraduate programs that are delivered completely online. Newsweek has said that one of the most radical redesigns in higher learning since the modern research university took shape in 19th century Germany is taking place at Arizona State University. And a recent editorial from the journal Nature observed that questions about the future of contemporary research university are being examined nowhere more searchingly than at Arizona State University. So over this period of time, over the course of the past decade, ASU has established more than a dozen new transdisciplinary schools, large research initiatives, and has nearly tripled research expenditures, now approaching $400 million annually. Enrollment during that time increased 27% to, just as I mentioned before, over 72,000 undergraduate and graduate students in the fall of 2011. Minority enrollment as a percentage of the total student population increased 44% to now 30% of the total student body are minority students. ASU was awarded more than 17,000 degrees in 2011, which is up more than 50% from 2002. At the same time, undergraduate degrees increased 42%. The six-year graduation rate for freshmen cohort entering in fall 2004 was only 58.7%, but of course we're expecting significant improvements as those graduation rates have time to transfer through the system. Even that was up 19% from the rate for the cohort that entered in the fall of 1995. Interestingly, though, and perhaps most importantly to us, freshman persistence in the fall of 2010 increased to 84%, which is almost 10% higher than fall of 2002. And in addition, the number of first-time, full-time, low-income Arizona freshmen increased 640% from 2008 through 2011. All of this was done while sustaining a $200 million reduction in support from the state. So how has this been done in the face of the challenges, again, many of which are being faced by other institutions across the country? Well, much of it, we believe, has been achieved through the institution's ability to leverage the data that we have available to us. And in fact, it's really not untrue to say that these results simply couldn't have been achieved without the use of analytics. So with that in the back of the way of background about ASU, let me turn it over to John Rome to describe some of the products and tools that we use at ASU. John?
Thanks, Gordon, and hello to everyone, and a special hello to all our ASU colleagues who have joined the call and joined us today. As Gordon said, I think it would be important to talk about some of the products that we've built to sort of help, what has really helped ASU with this analytic capability. I think first and foremost, when we look at the foundation of our analytic capability, it really starts with the enterprise data warehouse, or as we refer to as the data warehouse. As mentioned earlier, we were one of the first in higher ed to build the data warehouse, and in fact, I found a picture back from the Wayback Machine, back from 1992 or 93, showing the team that actually started the warehouse. And if you look to the far right there, that might be someone that looks a little bit familiar, a little skinnier, and a little more hair, and a little bit less gray. But this is the team that really started the effort back in the early 90s. And if you want to read more about that, there was actually an article written in EDUCAUSE publication back in 1995 about some of the things that we had done back in the early days of data warehousing. So I think it's important to mention that we, ASU, treats data as a strategic asset. And so one of the goals that we've tried to do is to put as much data as possible into our data warehouse. And, you know, no longer are there silos of data, or no longer it takes one phone call from the president or the CFO or the provost if someone wants to not put data into the data warehouse, as we look at it as strategic. And you can see there's just sort of a sample there of some of the data that we've made available in our data warehouse. And I think the other thing to mention, too, is that this is not something that we're finished. I mean, there's constantly new data that we're looking at putting into the data warehouse, whether it's social media data, whether it's door access data, whether it's the usage of Adobe Connect. Those are the type of things that we're looking at strategically, not only for analytics, but also usage patterns and just the ability to report as we consider ourselves a data-driven university. So we've both built a data warehouse, you know, as we call it now affectionately as the legacy data warehouse, and also after moving to an ERP vendor, ERP systems in the mid-2000s, we actually bought a data warehouse, and we looked at that as sort of a starter kit to give us a jump start on the, you know, sort of continuing our data warehouse build out. And I think it's good to mention, as we found out, it's really just sort of a starter kit that you really, to build the analytic capability, you really need to have a team in place and the ability to grow and expand that. One of the things I noticed, I actually took some core data recently to see, you know, what are institutions like those who have joined the call here, what are you doing out there? And surprised to find out that many of you have looked to have bought a solution out there, that there's very few homegrown solutions that are out there. So I think it's up to us collectively to push our vendors to make sure that, if, you know, the products that they build are really good and really can help us get a start in building this analytic capability and building this product. And also, I thought it would be a good time to put in a shameless plug. I think Diana and the others at EDUCAUSE, as myself, are big fans of the core data services, and we've participated most years, and the data that we get out of that is very helpful for us, whether it's student tech fees or just looking and seeing what other institutions are doing. So this is my shameless plug for Core Data Services. So I recommend that you try to get involved in that. And I think the deadline is August 3rd to add or to put your data out there. So the other product that we've developed is what we've branded as My Reports. And this is, before I talk about My Reports, I wanted to mention that we do have rocket scientists at ASU, and this is Dr. Phil Christensen, and he was one of our professors who built the thermal emission spectrometer on one of the Mars missions. And, you know, pretty smart guy. And we also had student rocket scientists out there. You can see some pictures there of some of them. And we really have a tool. We think the My Reports is really a tool for rocket scientists as we get more and more into the build. The more and more we built out this tool, it really is what we had at the time. It was good, but it's still not good enough. But we need the analytic capability. Our users need the ability to get access to data as well as build ad hoc reporting. And this is what this tool allows us to do. And this is the old Brio product for those who are familiar with the Brio product, now owned by, subsequently by Hyperion and Oracle. But, you know, the slide might be a little bit hard to see, but as you can look out there, you can see some of the folders that are out there that contain either queries or pre-built queries or blank queries that allow you to build additional queries or batch schedule queries that give you sort of a first initial start at queries. And these have been very helpful for our end users of having a place to go once you get the appropriate access. If I need to build a student advisement query, more than likely will be one that's out there ready for me to build or to tweak a little bit. And also this tool gives us the ability to save our own queries as well. So instead of storing data on your desktops, this tool allows us to build queries and save those results and save those queries in the server, so it's no longer that data is on our desktop. But that gives you a good example of the types of data that's available in the system out there. And so it might be Jennifer in the registrar's office who's building queries, Melinda in IR, or Jennifer in the provost office, or Nancy in engineering, or Ross in financial aid. Those are some of the folks who've been instrumental in making sure that we get content out there, understand this content, and then having this product for our rocket scientists to build out queries. And here's just an example query out there, the ad hoc capability. So it takes, you know, take some time and some learning to understand these data structures. Here's a list of tables here. And then you have the ability then to sort of drag and drop and run these queries, build pivot tables, and schedule ad hoc type queries. However, as we found out, not everyone's a rocket scientist at ASU. And that's where I think dashboards come into play. And as you can see, I saw this on the announcement early today. This was actually a sticky note that I got from the president, who said back in 2006, learn all you can about dashboards and see me. And there's actually a couple other drawn-up pictures as well as some of the things that he thought we needed to include in dashboards. But I think that this was permission for us to look at other tools out there. I think we had standardized on one tool and realized, hey, we could have multiple tools in our arsenal, in our BI arsenal, to help us deliver more and better content out there. And so back in 2006, we actually started looking at building out dashboards. And as you can see right here, and there's a URL at the bottom there, dashboards.edu. They'll give you a little more information about our dashboards. And now I'm going to pass it over to Leah, who can give us a little bit deeper dive into the dashboards and show some examples out there.
Yeah, thanks, John. I think what's important to know is that while many people want to be able to build their own reports, a lot of people just want to start looking at the analytics so they can act upon it. And so what we've done is made sure that anyone can get to the dashboards at any given time. We try to incorporate all of our tools so no one needs to think of URLs. So part of our portal is that the dashboards is a link from there. I understand this is a bit fuzzy. And then once they start getting into the dashboards, I'm going to run through a lot of examples of how we've pulled data together to help the university. And so if you have any questions, please post them below, and I can go into some further later on if we have time. But some of the first things we did is we have some initiatives here at Arizona State University where we track a student's progress in an individual program. And so these dashboards allow a very high-level view of where students are progressing in each individual program. Then we also take that and we start looking at how our class enrollment is doing. We know what classes students need to take, how can we predict that enrollment, and we can give indicators like the little red and yellow dots that tell us when a class is approaching being full, and we can work directly with colleges to get more capacity in seats before students are out of luck. The dashboards also help us present all data about individuals. So we were able to create mashups of data from lots of different systems and present it in a way so that any dean can look up a particular faculty member, see all the research they've done, what classes they've taught, and really give a nice view of what a faculty has on their particular profile. Then we also, I think I saw on UW's, they said free the data, or you know, the single version of the truth is sometimes how we like to call it. And the research information that shows quickly your burn rate on your individual research projects has really helped our researchers move forward faster by having all this data at their fingertips. And some of these dashboards, like this burn rate I'm showing you, this one dashboard actually helped increase the amount of adoption to dashboards across the university, because we have an archaic financial system, and to understand those reports was rocket science, and then trying to tie that to HR data and other data was almost impossible. So by us creating these dashboards, folks almost came and kissed our feet for it. Well, we'd like to think that anyway. So the next adventure we've been approaching is, Gord mentioned how our retention numbers have improved, but it's a never-ending battle. So we partook in an exercise to start looking at all the different indicators as to why a student might leave the university, and our dashboards expose for each individual college ways that they can start intervening with students across the different systems, whether it be a financial aid issue or their usage of the actual portal itself, or if they've had transcripts sent. So by exposing this data, they can then start drilling in and learning more about a student to decide on what the next best action is. I see many of you use PeopleSoft. We all know how hard it is to get a complete picture of a student just in PeopleSoft alone for that data. And then there's data outside of PeopleSoft, such as your residence life systems, and you want to know what's going on there. So our dashboards help mash all that together and allow people to then take action on it. So from our dashboards, we've linked it into some of our enterprise systems, such as PeopleSoft, so that someone can take the next step. So once you look at a student and understand a retention need, you can actually act upon that data and start reaching out to your students from there. So it's important not just to know your data, but to know how you want to start acting upon it at some given point as you expose more and more institutional effectiveness issues. That retention dashboard has helped us tremendously in understanding our students a lot. John and Gordon both mentioned our rise in retention rates, which has been attributed a lot to eAdvisor, which is a system we put together looking at programs and advising students on when to take what courses. And that eAdvisor one allows students to know where they stand. So analytics isn't just a tool for, say, an administrator to use, or dashboards for someone like a provost to see. Yes, it's high level, but you want to be able to crunch that information down to also offer it to your staff and your students for them to also be able to progress. So with that, since we just wowed you with a zillion things we've done with data, Gordon and the rest of us, we're going to kind of help share some of our best practices.
So this is a combination of best practices and lessons learned, and I think really the first lesson and really best practice is leadership support. Clearly, leadership support is needed. ASU certainly has it. Institutional leadership that understands the value of the data and the willingness and ability to leverage that data. And at our institution, of course, it starts at the top with Dr. Crow. Our provost, Betty Capaldi, has driven many, many changes throughout the structure and the organization of the academy. And, of course, support from our CFO is essential as well. So, ultimately, I really can't stress it enough, the institutional leadership from the president, the provost, to the deans, Individual department chairs need to have processes in place that permit the rapid change necessary in the academy, and of course meaningful change, changes in structure, changes in programs, and of course changes to approaches to teaching individual courses. And so at ASU, the leadership, and especially the provost here, has been able to drive very rapid change throughout the academy. We also try to encourage a data-driven culture. We think that we've achieved this largely at ASU. Culture, of course, needs to be data-driven and starts at the top. We no longer have to rely upon anecdotal information, and certainly there's much less guessing about a student's performance and what makes a student successful here at ASU than used to be the case. This data-driven culture was highlighted in a publication recently by the Education Advisory Board that may be available to some. Sarah and Bill talked a lot about governance and policies, and certainly effective policies must be in place here at ASU. Many of those policies were created early in the data warehouse days. Open access to people who needed access to data to do their jobs is essential. It's also essential that you have processes in place to ensure that that access is available only to trusted employees. You have workflow and approval processes in place to support that. And in addition, the data trustees, data stewardship policies, and overall data governance, as it's the case at UW, is absolutely essential to success. Here at ASU, we also have a dedicated BI team. This might answer some of the questions about the size of the teams now. Let me stress, though, here that while we have a fairly small dedicated BI team here, the actual leveraging and use of the tools that we have is spread far and wide across the institution, particularly in the provost office and in the academic departments. So roughly 4% of the total IT staff, centralized IT staff here at ASU work on BI, but as I said, the impact and utilization of those tools is much broader than that. So you can see some of the other stats associated with our approach here at ASU. We've also taken great pains to include and involve students in the effort, not only as student developers, but as you'll see from John later, some of our students sometimes have volunteered to be guinea pigs and assist us in helping to understand what makes students tick, what makes students successful, and potentially what influences their behavior relative to academics. And certainly dashboards have been a huge aid to ASU in increasing the consumption of data. Dashboards make it easy for users to get information. The data is downloadable through Excel and Acrobat, and we were afraid early on that providing these dashboards would cause some cannibalization of the My Reports users. They'd be less likely to run their own queries, but in fact, we found that we captured an entirely new audience of users when we deployed dashboards. But finally, I think, and perhaps most important, is being able to act on the information and having processes, procedures, structures in place within the academy, and ultimately the ability of the provost and the deans and the department chairs to act with agility and really with conviction in making changes to programs. And I won't go into any of the changes in structure or programs that ASU has implemented here, but they have been widespread and really fundamental changes in our approach. And then I guess I should also mention one of John's favorite topics is go ahead and use BI on top of your BI. That is, we employ business intelligence to actually see how people are using our analytics tools and the dashboards themselves and creating feedback to allow us to make our dashboards even better. It helps to monitor adoption and usage. This is another example of a dashboard, information dashboard, if you will. It's a drill down that shows our top users, a calendar-based heat map on when certain dashboards are used, and a report on who we think should be used based on using the dashboards based on their titles and departments. So at this point, I'll turn it back over to Leah and John to talk about where we're headed with all of this effort at ASU in the future.
Yeah, one quick note. You have to remember to have fun on some of the things you're doing. So we track the usage of dashboards, and when we release the retention dashboard, many of you know John Rome is really like a godfather of BI, and those of us who are fortunate enough to work with him are always feeling like we'll never be able to keep up. We're always going to be in John's shadow. So we had a little competition when we released the retention dashboard, which was one of the first major dashboards we did without John holding our hand the entire way, to see if we could use it compared to any of his dashboards. So I really pushed it hard for all of our advisors to use it, and it quickly rose to be one of our top used dashboards. So a little friendly competition trying to keep up with our godfather, John Rome, has been a little bit fun, although he's still the master for sure. And he's pushing us forward. So one of the things that we want to do is start looking at more predictive analytics and make sure we get really smart people, like we mentioned. And what we're finding is that IT people can't do this alone. We actually are starting to look at how to bring mathematicians, modelers, statisticians, and that kind of brain level in to some of the work that we've been doing.
Some of the other things that we're looking at doing, well, thanks for those kind words too, Leah, by the way. The other thing that we're trying to look a little bit deeper into is the LMS data. And so we've done some preliminary work of understanding our Blackboard LMS data of just sort of inventory type things. But if you remember, for those of you who attended on the first day, UMBC, they've gone deep into LMS analytics, and we're huge fanboys of John Fritz and some of their folks there, and looking at maybe collaborating with them. But we think that there's a lot to learn from LMS analytics and getting access to that data, and maybe even rolling it into our retention tool. And we have, you know, in terms of, this is some of its behavioral data. So we have over 4 million rows a day of students out there interacting with our LMS, which we think is a great source of understanding our students better.
Then, of course, mobile, delivering everything we do via mobile. In fact, starting to change our mindset. Instead of thinking how you're going to deliver something on a PC, how are we going to deliver it via mobile? And how are we going to use those mobile analytics to help us make decisions for our students?
The other thing that we're looking at doing is that, you know, beyond dashboards, we think that there's just other nice visualization tools out there, whether they're from Google that you can find online, or just visualizations like tree maps, heat maps, bubble charts, maps, bullet charts. There's just a wide variety of tools out there. Or types of visualizations that help tell a better story. So I think we've moved beyond just the pie charts and the bar charts and just text tables. That, you know, in addition to providing those type of visualizations, to provide other ones that help tell the story better. And I think, you know, sort of, and as you can see, there's a few examples out there. The one up in the left hand corner talks about, you know, someone watching a video, and wouldn't it be nice of watching a lecture in our LMS systems to know when students stop watching a particular video, when did they spend most of the time on. Those are the type of visualizations I think that we will need to help understand our students to provide better services as well as help student performance. And there's just some other examples of, I think that there'll be a big push in the next couple of years for infographics, where maybe infographics out of the box where you can put information in and help tells a nice story, an interesting story as well.
So since we're running out of time, we want to get to QA. We also would just want to talk about, make sure that we're going to start looking at more data outside of what we have at ASU. So how can we use maybe Amazon data or something like that? And then we've been playing with big data, which is a very hot topic out there, using Hadoop. And John made that big, huge Starbucks cup just for me. and then playing with that Hadoop output data, and then one more plug saying that, you know, we love ASU and we're very challenged here, and we get to do good things. So with that, what kind of questions can we entertain from everyone?
We've got both some very specific questions and some really big picture kinds of questions, but maybe we can start with some of the details, such as who builds the queries, can end users across campus create ad hoc reports without using the dashboards. So a lot of questions about who builds the queries, who builds the dashboards, what do the students do. Maybe you can help us understand a little more.
Sure. Well, so we kind of talked about the evolution. It started with getting a data warehouse, then we had a reporting tool, and now we have a dashboard. So we have over 4,000 people across ASU who can build any report ad hoc at any given time. And then we have even more users of the dashboard. So reports can be written by anyone who gets sign off to access certain data. The dashboards themselves do take developers, and we use a product that was originally created by a company called Corda, now called Domo, in a product called CenterView. And we have a small team of dashboard developers in our BI team that does most of the dashboard development, but we also work collaboratively with other units across campus on the design of those. So our provost office, our business technology office, all those people kind of contribute to what we generate.
So a specific question for John, I think. Somebody said, is the data warehouse really 400 gigabytes? And John, one of the questions is that your data warehouse is pretty large. How do you plan for and manage the growth from the perspective of data complexity as well as hardware and hosting?
That's a great question. And so one of the things you'll think if you noticed on the slide, on our BI slide, is that we actually host our data warehouse. We host our BI tools actually at ASU, but then we point them to a hosted solution where we also host our PeopleSoft solution. So we work closely with that vendor, and of course we have data on growth patterns, so we have we're actually built tables out there to watch what daily growth is, and then we work with our vendor to make sure that we have the appropriate hardware, the appropriate throughput to provide that type of service. So that's how we do that.
Great. So let me ask you one that is much more strategic. And the question is, does data as a strategic asset equate to competitive advantage, especially with private online education organizations exploding?
So I guess I'll tackle that one. I think, you know, it's not customary for institutions to talk about competitive advantage, for educational institutions to talk about competitive advantage, but certainly we're finding ourselves competing more and more with, as you mentioned, purely online for-profit institutions, as well as, quite honestly, for students. In our among our strategic goals is to grow the institution even further in a way that we can better serve the citizens of the state of Arizona, but ultimately to provide access to students from anywhere across the country or around the world that qualify to attend Arizona State University. So clearly we are competing in many ways for students and for resources, and I think it's absolutely true that treating data as a strategic asset, the ability to leverage the data, and really the ability to act with agility, it is certainly a competitive advantage for our institution as we pursue the ultimate goals of the institution.
And maybe one final question, and that is that as the dashboards increase ease of use, the selection of what is captured and how it's represented requires a lot of decisions. And how do you approach the decision-making process, and what would you recommend for others?
So I'd like to ask Leah and John to comment on this too, but I'd first say that there are a lot of people who would argue that that it's possible to misuse the data. Particularly, it's possible to misuse data if the data is bad, if you have a lot of bad data. And you can it's certainly possible to draw incorrect or inappropriate conclusions from data, whether the data is good or bad. So we put a lot of thought, a great deal of thought, into how the data is used and who has access to which elements of data. In addition to that, we also put a lot of effort into understanding the data, and I think another of those best practices or lessons learned is that you must really understand the data that you have. It's not good enough simply to pull a feed of data in from any source without an effective understanding of that data and expect to get to draw effective conclusions from that data. John, Leah, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I think that one of the big things is we're talking because we're from the University Technology Office, but we actually just help many of the brilliant people across campus. So when you ask what we would recommend for others is get your user groups together of your different tools, pull out the experts from your registrar's office, your provost's office, your institutional research, and make sure everyone there agrees with the data definitions and what the goals of exposing this data are going to be. Because if you expose bad data, people will lose trust in your tool. So getting the buy-in of all of our customers and everything else has been huge, and they actually come to us with ideas of the next dashboard and everything else. It's been amazing.
In addition to that, I think Leah's point is right, that we really look to our customers really to drive the dashboard development. The other thing we do, too, is we watch my reports and the ad hoc reports. So we have a dashboard on top of that as well. And so if we see heavy usage in some subject area of data or the business, we actually then inquire saying, okay, a lot of people want access to this data. Should we then build a dashboard to make it for the more casual user to get access to that?
And I guess I would just add again that it's very easy to misuse data. We take great pains to use this data to inform decisions, but not to make decisions. And so our provosts, our deans, our department chairs, our faculty and advisors, and even the students that we provide this data to are using that as just one additional indicator, an important indicator, but one additional means of ultimately making decisions.
Thank you. There's certainly a lot more we could talk about, but we are just about at the end of our time. So I want to thank Gordon, John, Leah, Sarah, and Bill on behalf of EDUCAUSE, as well as everyone who's joined us today. And before you all sign off, would you take a moment to click on the session evaluation link, which you'll find at the bottom corner of your screen, because we'd really like to hear from you. And if you missed any part of today's conversation, or if you want to see some or all of it again, it will be archived on the EDUCAUSE Sprint website, including the slides and a complete replay of the session. And I hope you'll join us now on IdeaScale, which is our conversation hub for the Sprint, to continue today's conversation. And you can access IdeaScale also from the Sprint website. So thank you all for joining us. Thanks again to Gordon, John, Leah, Sarah, and Bill. This is Diana Oblinger. Thanks for being here.